have recorded a short history about the canals and hedgerows in Britain on this tape. Now, it is not spoiled by noises, so please listen to it and give me your opinion. I think that you might find it interesting. The history of the canals and waterways in Britain is very interesting, to say the least. Blossoming when they did in the 18th century, our highways were poor at that time, with lack of maintenance, thereby causing deep ruts and in wet weather mile after mile of quagmire, and besides they were too narrow. All this, together with the possibility of being robbed by the notorious highwaymen whilst travelling along the so-called highways in those days, prompted the merchants and mill owners to seek alternative transport, hoping to avoid the exasperating chaos and congestion which would eventually cause the consumption of commerce and the decline of the Industrial Revolution. Consequently, a network of 6,000 miles of inland waterways was established, and they formed the vital arteries between the bustling factory towns and mills to the seaports. Fresh canals were being dug and opened well into the 19th century, but that was until the advent of the railways. Then they were doomed and began to decline rapidly. That would be about 1830. About 50% of the canal system was closed and abandoned because of the very stiff opposition of the railways. Today, life is slowly returning to these old canals. But the beautifully coloured commercial barge has given way to the hired motor launch, the sailing yacht and the canoe. On the towpaths, once trodden by the magnificent barge horses, hikers wander, while anglers sit on the banks under the green umbrellas. The 3,000 miles of canals have now become Britain's newest and, I think, best leisure and pleasure ground. The attraction of the canals today is their loneliness and beauty, meandering through the countryside. They seem to follow their own secret routes. They penetrate right through the heart of the land, away from the noise and bustle of the railways and roads. Well, they do meet, but only here and there. Now, each canal has its own character, but the difference cannot be seen from a distance. You have to travel along the banks, or better still, by boat. Some towns and villages owe their existence to them, because they sprang up where the wharves and the warehouses were built, along with shops, cottages and a pub. Now, boatmen lived in the cottages with their families, of course. That was until the railways forced the mill owners and the traders to lower their prices so much that the boatmen were forced to abandon the cottages and live with their families on the barges. Now, to accommodate the needs of the boatmen, inns sprang up along the canals, and they are still there today. As I stated before, the ideal way to explore the canals is by boat. You pass under humped-backed bridges, over numerous viaducts, through secretive tunnels that open out into fresh displays of beauty and grandeur on either side. And the best thing about it is, you can take your time and look properly, instead of riding past at speed in a car or coach. Every year now, more and more stretches of canals are being renovated and repaired, so that they too can be enjoyed by the growing number of people eager to share their delights. On some urban sections, there is no right of way, but you can walk along the banks in the rural areas, but at your own risk. Now, wildlife is in abundance along the canals, particularly in the Fen District and the Wash. So much so that a vast variety of plant life and wild birds in certain stretches of the waterways have been designated as nature reserves and bird sanctuaries. That gives one the opportunity to observe close at hand what nature has to offer, and without undue restriction. There are two types of canals in Britain. There's the broad and the narrow. The reason for this is that they were constructed by different engineers, and they were built according to the needs of the district, depending on the requirements in the area. Now let's put matters in perspective first. The determining factor of a canal is the locks, as the length, and more important, the width. Now, a narrow canal will take a barge of up to 7 foot wide, whereas a broad canal lock will take a boat with a 12 foot beam, that's the width. In the Fens, the length of a boat up to 45 foot and a 10 foot 6 inch wide beam, and beam of course, and on the rivers of course you get boats from 55 foot to 174 foot long with a 10 foot to 19 foot beam. That depends on which waters they play, of course. Let's go on a bit and talk about the ones in Scotland, if you're not bored. I think I will be right in saying that there are only two canals of significance in Scotland. There's the Crinan and the well-known Caledonian. That is apart from a stretch remaining of the old Union Canal that used to be. There's about 30 miles of it remaining west from Edinburgh. Now, you see, because all bridges on this canal are permanently lowered, it is only used for towpath walks and fishing and canoeing. The Crinan is a 5 mile stretch, or I should say not a 5 mile, a 9 mile stretch, I do beg your pardon, a 9 mile stretch used as a shortcut by the seagoing vessels. And there are no facilities for pleasure craft on it. The Caledonian is a different kettle of fish altogether. 60 miles of it altogether. so I understand anyway. That is, with the locks, etc. The waterway itself has in it actually 22 miles of canal with 29 locks running right across Scotland. And they connect Loch Ness, Loch Oich, Loch Lochy and Loch Lyne. The canal passes through dramatic highland scenery. The boats sail almost within the shadow of Ben Nevis, and at three places, Barnavee, Fort Augustus and Inverness, the canal locks are in flights. At Barnavee, there's a flight of locks known as Neptune's Staircase, lifting sea-going vessels 64 feet. There are numerous swing bridges, all manned, crossing the canal, including two railway swing bridges through which the commercial vessels traffic usually has priority. Now this canal passes vessels, 150 foot long with a 35 foot beam and a 13 foot 6 inch draft, and the speed limit is 6 miles an hour, but it's unrestricted in open water. There is a charge made, and advance notice must be given for using the canal on Sundays, when an extra charge is made. Mooring points are few, but buoys are being laid for overnight anchorage. Now, great care must be taken when passing through the open water of this canal, because the weather can change very suddenly, and this in turn can make your trip most uncomfortable. I think that I've covered the important features of the Caledonian, so let's move on a bit, shall we? Before I continue, may I point out that most of this information I'm giving you I have gleaned from books, and as far as I can ascertain, it is correct. To go on, that's if you're interested. I believe that Birmingham has the largest urban waterway network in Britain. It was owned by the Birmingham Navigation. Now, whether that is still the case, I don't know. I can tell you though that its canals radiate to five main river estuaries. There used to be 160 miles of navigable water in that area at one time. Now there's about 100. Although they run through big industrial areas, the canals are still remote, and you can moor in peace even in the middle of Birmingham. There are stretches that run through some lovely wooded countryside. Also in that network are some 120 locks. There are four tunnels as well in the area. There's the Dudley, the Netherton, the West Hill and the Egbaston. Those are the important ones, of course. Now then, the Netherton was the last canal tunnel to be built in Britain. And it's 3,028 yards long. It was opened, in 1858. I think I remember that rightly. This tunnel was lit by gas throughout, but was later switched over to electricity. Now, it has a towpath on either side. And that's unusual, because tunnels usually don't have a towpath. they end, the towpath ends at the mouth of any tunnel, except that one. And the boats have to be legged through. That means that the boatmen lay on boards on the boat and push the boat through by pushing their feet against the side of the roof or the roof of the tunnel. Now the dramatic and cavernous Dudley Tunnel, 3,172 yards long, was restored and reopened in 1973. Much of this is unlined rock, and it opens out into large grottos, which branch with branches leading off to now abandoned underground workings. I will attempt to describe a canal lock and how it operates. So let's have a bit of fun, shall we? Now, I can remember. First of all, a canal lock, is a chamber in which a boat can be floated from one level to another. Now that's obvious, isn't it? So that's straight. The wooden gates, which, by the way, are elm or oak, always point uphill so that water pressure forces them together. Don't forget that every time a lock is used, water is drained down the canal. So it is most important not to waste water by incorrectly closing gates and paddles. So if the lock is empty, when your boat is going downhill mind you, fill the lock up by opening the ground paddles, which let water in through the culverts. If there are gate paddles only, raise them slowly. When the lock is full, open the top gates and enter. Then close the paddles and the gates. After that, open the bottom paddles so that the lock empties, and keep the boat clear of the sill that is underneath the top gates. Just underneath the top gates. Don't secure the boat to the bollards, for heaven's sake. But if you do, your boat will be left high and dry. Now, as the lock empties, just get one of the crew to hold the motor in line from the side of the lock, just to steady it. Now, when the boat has floated down and the lock is empty, open the bottom gates and leave the lock. That is, unless there's a boat approaching, or one already waiting to enter the lock, to go past you, and therefore uphill. And close the bottom paddles and gates so that a following boat can repeat the maneuver you have just completed. Remember to close all gates at the top lock of a flight and the last lock after a long stretch of canal. And close your gates by hand and wind down the paddles. Never, on any account, drop the paddles suddenly or slam the gates, because this may cause unnecessary damage to the lock and also to yourself. If a lock is closed against you, when you arrive at one, don't empty or fill it if a boat is approaching from the opposite direction. And a similar sequence is used for going uphill through a lock. Now, all that sounds complicated, but if you can take it step by step, you will see how simple it really is. If you care to take a close look at the aqueducts bridges and tunnels in Britain, you find that they are very impressive. Impressive monuments of British engineering feats of the late 18th and early 19th century. They were built by an army of navigators, workmen, and that's where the term navvy comes from, isn't it? They had some help from horses, of course, they had to use a couple of horses or so, and maybe a steam pump. But the real hard graft was the digging by hand in all weathers. A striking example of the engineering is the aqueduct on the Shropshire Union Canal. It consists of a cast iron trough perched on stone piers 120 foot over the Dee Valley. I understand that when the plans were first drawn up by Mr. Thomas Telford, excuse me, they were derided and scoffed at by his contemporaries. Nevertheless, the aqueduct was opened in 1805, and even today, the dovetail joints in the iron trough hardly leak. The longest tunnel ever built was on the Huddersfield Narrow Canal. It runs through the Pennines for about 5,456 yards. And in some places, it's 600 feet below ground. It is now in disuse. So there's a lot of work there that was done for nothing, more or less. More's the pity. But that's how it goes. Adding to the beauty and enhancing the scenery of the canals, or as I stated earlier, the humped-backed bridges made of stone and the gracefully curving cast-iron ones. But probably the most attractive are the roving bridges, which enabled a barge horse to cross from one side of the canal to the other without the tow rope being detached from the barge. The horse tows the boat onto the bridge, then walks back over the bridge, trailing the rope over the parapet. There's another magnificent three-arch aqueduct over the River Goyt at Marple, which carries the Peak Forest Canal, and that's 100 foot up. The intricate flowery designs and family names painted on the barges give the boatman and his family that individual character, like a trademark or brand name, not unlike so many familiar household names. And don't they look well, gliding along, not far from the bank, within shouting distance, appearing, as it were, from the past and on their way to the future. What is so nice about the whole picture is the stealthy-like approach, the serene, almost majestic float past, and the departure with only the sound of water lapping along the side of the canal bank. Now, another aspect of interest are the peculiar designs and shapes of the bollards along the sides of the canal where they moor the boats. And at the wharves too, the old wharves there, where the boats tied up. You see, the continuing searing and scorching of these bollards by the mooring ropes over the years have given them a very unusual and eerie design and shape. It has been announced recently by the media that another 84 miles of canal has just been opened to the public, as far as I can make out anyway. And it's somewhere in the Avon district, although I'm not certain exactly as to the location. But Alton it is. I'm given to understand there are many more locks and lovely walks to enjoy along these banks. Now, so far, I have spoken about the canals because of the interest that they create, and who knows, perhaps one day we may be able to get an update about the total mileage and conditions of these amenities, which have been so neglected in the past. I don't think there's a cheaper way of having a holiday in Britain, and the best thing is, you are not tied down to one particular place. Apart from boating, the boating hire and fishing permits, and that, everything is more or less free. Water museums are beginning to spring up here and there. For instance, let me think now. There's one at a place called Stoke Bruin, and that's beside the Grand Union Canal in Northants, you know, near Tolster. They have an important historical collection of waterway relics there from the past 200 years. And then maybe you could visit the one in Exeter, the Exeter Maritime Museum, on the Exeter Canal, of course. They have a collection of boats from all over the world. There's many more canals that I haven't mentioned. The quarter few. You get the Leeds and Liverpool, the Lancaster, the Bridgewater, and the Manchester Ship Canal, along with its Barton Bridge, the Trent and Mersey, with the Hardcastle Tunnel, is it called? And the Shropshire and Union, and the Stafford and Worcester, and yes, there's plenty more. But two new ones for me to mention. Looking at the maps of the canal that I have, it would be possible to sail from the west coast across Britain to the east coast, or vice versa. And although it would be a long journey, it would be a very interesting one at that. Let me attempt to enlighten you with some interesting and historical facts appertaining to our local canals. Now, I haven't much to go on, and just what I've gleaned from reading about. For a start, in 1798, canal communication between Preston and Tewett Field, that's a place near Burton in Westmorland, was established. This was via Lancaster, and it was a success at the time, so it was extended to Kendal. And that was in 1833. The same company prospered and extended the canal from Preston to Wigan. Of course, that was earlier still. That was in 1802. Therefore, the Wigan-Preston part of the canal is about 21 years older than the Burton to Kendal section. Now, all this seriously interfered with the coaching trade, obviously, because in 7 years, from 1830 to 1837, the number of coaches running to and from Preston dwindled from 81 to 12. And then in 1842, they ceased altogether. The railways were getting established about that time, you see. and they safe, leisurely traveled along the canal of about 10 miles an hour, gave way to a more modern and faster mode of travel. In 1840, a portion of the canal between Preston and Lancaster was leased to the railway company. Shortly afterwards, passenger traffic along that part of the canal ceased. In turn, what the canals did to the coaching trade, the railways did to the canals. The railways were extended to Kendal, and in 1846, all passenger traffic along the Preston to Kendal Canal ceased, just leaving the goods traffic such as stone, sand and coal and grain, of course. And this state of affairs continued for a considerable length of time. Now, I want to go back a little to 1802. Remember I said that canal traffic was extended to Wigan from Preston. And that was from the near the bottom of War Street in Preston to the summit near Bamber Bridge. There was a tramway connection. The canal beyond the summit was leased to the Leeds and Liverpool, so it was part of the Leeds and Liverpool Canal. And during the Guild of 1822, they did run a canal packet, what they call a canal packet, from Preston to Lancaster, twice a day. And I believe that such a journey involved, at that time, loads of celerity and was looked upon as a very choice and wonderful thing. Traffic, meanwhile, on this tramway continued even after railways had leased the canal north of Preston. The tramway consisted of two lines of rails, and its distance from Preston to the summit was about 5 miles. Only wagons ran on it, 8 to 9 constituting a train. They're only small, and they were drawn by horses, maybe 2 or 3, according to the number that made the train. They pulled the train along the whole way, with the exception of that part traversing Avenham Brow on the Preston side. There they were drawn up and let down this brow, which was, as I was saying, they were drawn up and let down this brow, which was very steep, by a stationary engine, which was in a building near where the Belvedere stood. Whether it is still there today or not, I haven't checked, so it may be, it may not, I don't know. Now, in 1859, the wagons, which for some years had been used for carrying coal, stopped running altogether, and the engine house, along with the adjoining cottages, was deserted, but I don't think that the tall chimney, which was after all an eyesore, was left standing. A bit of local history, but here's a bit more. According to some old records, from what I've read, a Mr. John Proctor, who lived in Preston, was the last horse driver of that tramway and was employed for 32 years, making the journey twice a day. That was 20 miles.
a day, partly riding and partly walking. And it's estimated that he travelled a distance of 199,000 miles during his work on the tramway. Also, during his career, he evidently did more walking when he was younger. So much so that it rendered it necessary for him to have his clogs resoled every week. And that's that. Now, another snippet of informative history is that in 1826, do you know that the government of the day passed 80 turnpike acts for Lancashire alone? Well, I'm saying it was in the space of 25 years, like, but still, 80 is quite a lot in 25 years, is it not? That meant that toll bars were in existence even then. And that meant that tax was payable, wasn't it? It must have been. You call it. You sure you call that tax? You know, as early as the 1800s. It makes one think what will happen now that the present government are considering the privatisation of roads again. Some roads, anyway. Now, ever since the 18th century, an enormous amount of hedgerows have been planted. Well, most of them were planted with nursery-raised stock. But a great proportion was with wild seedlings, chiefly hawthorn. As time went on, you know, more species appeared. They were probably carried on the wind or dropped by birds. Now, the hedgerows have indeed matured along the canals, and most of them are shrub and woodland origin. The combined conditions of light, humidity, and the soil decides the type of hedgerow grown in any area. You may get the picture when I say that roughly 600,000 miles of hedgerow grows in Britain. Now, that's a lot. That would be an acreage of 436,000. Now, that's twice as much as the country's nature reserves acreage. Trees, shrubs, plants and grasses make an ideal home for birds, insects and small animals. Now, these hedgerows connect with woods and forests, so it's like a kind of highway for the wildlife. It was in the 18th century that Acts of the Land were passed to provide separate space for cattle grazing and crop growing. Now, hedges were the ideal thing because they were cheaper than building walls or fences. They consisted of hawthorn with elm trees planted at intervals. Some hedges, however, were established long before that. They were planted by the Saxons to create boundaries between estates. And some of the thousand-year-old hedges exist today. This practice developed slowly through the Middle Ages. right until the major enclosure movement that came about under the Tudors about 400 years ago, isn't it? And primarily that was done for the sheep. Now, did you know that botanists can date hedges by counting the number of different shrubs growing in them? For example, as a rough guide, hedges have one species of shrub growing in them for every 100 years growth in each 30 yards stretch. Have you got that? It's a bit awkward at all, but it's there. Put it this way. They count the number of different species of shrub in every 30 yards. For instance, a Saxon hedge has 10 different species of shrub in every 30 yards. So a Tudor hedge will have around 3 or 4, won't it? I hope you can work it out anyway, better than I can. To go on. For nearly 25 years before 1970, about 4,500 miles of hedgerow were torn up each year. This was to allow the giant agricultural machinery to perform more efficiently. But since 1970, this has declined somewhat. You see, when a hedge is removed, it means rather sadly that a sanctuary is lost forever for the animals that lived in the hedgerow at that time. Now, the animals among the animals that live in the hedgerow, you see, are mice, rabbits, voles, badgers and foxes. A well-looked-after hedge contains many more varieties of plant life than a natural one because of the light factor. It's not as thick as it, and so therefore you get a chance to grow. Dozens of types of birds live in the hedgerows as well. That's because of the thousands of insects that dwell there. Among the 91 species of birds that live in the lowlands in Britain, 65 species live in hedges. There's no richer variety of life than the plants that live and grow along the banks of canals and amongst the hedgerows. There's about 30 different woody species that grow in the hedgerows itself. The most common are the elm and you get the field maple and the hawthorn, of course. Then there's the holly, oak, privet, and the wire rose. Not forgetting the sycamore. If you care to look more closely along the canal banks and in the hedgerows, you'll find another, wait for it, 500 species of plants all growing by God's good grace. And ask any herbalist and they'll tell you the useful remedies that some of them are. And please remember that a great number of those plants were growing long before the Neolithic farmers at first cleared the forests over 5,000 years ago. Now, that word, Neolithic, it
comes from the dictionary, and it means that the later Stone Age, the latter Stone Age, when ground or stone weapons and tools were used, when they prevailed. But to go on. As I stated earlier, since the 18th century, 50% of the British hedgerows have been planted deliberately from wild seedlings or nursery-raised stock. While no wild flower or plant is confined to the canal banks or hedges, many species are characteristic climbers, such as the dog rose and the honeysuckle and the black bryony. There are a group of plants that do need very moist ground in which to flourish. They grow either completely submerged or right beside the water's edge. And, pardon me, several species of trees are found only in such places, particularly the alder and several kinds of willow. Among the herbaceous plants that root in the water are the watercress, the water crowfoot, and others of similar character. Growing in wet soil are the kingcup, meadowsweet, and yellow flag, and that type of thing. There's plenty of comfrey and teasel growing on the banks. Now, farmers and gardeners can tell you the type of soil in a field by the type of wildflowers, or weeds that they like to call them, growing there. For example, Scarlet Pimpernel and White Compline are more likely to be in chalky or limestone soils, whereas Sheep's Sorrel denotes an acid or sandy soil. Well, there are so many fascinating things to talk about concerning canals and the countryside. A person can go on for hours and still not complete the picture. So I'm going to finish, but before doing so, there's just one thing may I remind you of, and that is, most of what I have spouted here on this tape, I have read about. So that means, please, observe the copyright laws, and then things should be all right, I think. And that's it. Well, I hope you like that. If I can find or, shall we say, tape other things of interest that would be of interest to you, of course, I'll be only too pleased to do it, although I must say that they're not just 5 minute jobs, but that's up to you. If you think of something that you would you think I could tape, I'll always be willing to try. And, of course, the thing is, you can either accept or reject them, can't you? That way, no one gets hurt, I won't get hurt, and by refusal, and everything will be okay. Because, after all, I must say that this particular type of thing I'm doing at the moment is a kind of hobby, and I think it's far more interesting than watching television all the time, or one thing or another. I can keep at this and it keeps me occupied, and I think myself that it doesn't do my brain any harm to be exercised as much as possible. Well, that's it.